Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got two key economic reports today. One on gross domestic product. Yes, it is still growing. The other one on housing. And yes, it is still recovering. They are kind of like the tip of the iceberg, though. It's the part that's underwater that's really dangerous. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 24th of November. Christmas trees are already going up across the country, so I guess it's not too early to bring a little Charles Dickens into the conversation. You remember in A Christmas Carol how Ebenezer Scrooge was visited by the ghosts of Christmas's past, present, and future? Well, we got a little past, present, and future ourselves today. First, the past. One of the big housing market indicators revealed this morning that home prices were still going up as of September. The S&P Case-Shiller Index showed prices in 20 major cities rose about a third of 1% last month. That is the fourth straight month of increases. Then there's the present. The real estate information company First American CoreLogic reported today one in four homeowners are underwater. That is, they owe more on their mortgage than the house is worth. That, in turn, brings us to the future and Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
Not surprisingly, the underwater mortgages are concentrated in the states that have felt the housing bust the most. Arizona, California, Florida, and Nevada, where 65% of borrowers are underwater. Former Fed economist Morris Davis teaches in the real estate department at the University of Wisconsin. He says about 10% of the underwater homeowners are likely to default, but the rest will probably stick it out.
Because a lot of people don't want to walk away from their house, and even the people that are tempted to walk away from their house, they don't want to face the market punishment that walking away would inflict on them.
Like a visit from a collection agency or a low credit score. But Davis says even homeowners who plan to keep paying their mortgages may behave differently toward their homes.
For example, you have less incentive now to maintain your property, because any dollar you spend maintaining your property is a dollar that goes to your mortgage company, not to you as a homeowner.
And that'll send home prices down further. Lenders don't want that to happen any more than homeowners do. Andrew Jakobovics is a housing expert at the Center for American Progress in Washington. He says many lenders are racing to modify mortgages so homeowners don't give up on their properties.
If you, in fact, take the properties, those are losses that you have to realize today. Whereas if you're modifying the loan, you're taking a much smaller loss today, especially if it's a permanent modification, but the expected risk, right, that exists with that property is smaller because you've got now what's an affordable payment for the homeowner.
And since homes are usually the biggest single expense for Americans, mortgage modifications can ripple across the economy. Homeowners who feel confident about their mortgages may be more likely to spend on everything from a new paint job to a new TV. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
President Obama is set to announce a new round of government spending next week, not more economic stimulus or bank bailouts. The president said today he will present his plans for Afghanistan, perhaps as early as Tuesday. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to start running the numbers for us on how high the tab for that one might go.
So how much will expanding the Afghan war effort really cost?
Well, you know, we've had estimates ranging from as low as an average of $500,000 per new soldier to $1 million or more per soldier.
David Berto is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says that means a 30,000-troop surge could cost anywhere from $15 billion a year to twice that. But really, he says when it comes to costs, it's mostly guesswork.
None of those estimates, of course, actually tie back to the historical record.
John Pike at globalsecurity.org believes the estimates floated around Washington are a joke.
No, I mean, you can make these numbers come out any way you want to.
Pike says for years, the Pentagon has used war funding bills for Iraq and Afghanistan for other purposes not related to the war. In 2006, two-thirds of all the Army's new equipment was paid for this way. So today, no one really knows what these wars have actually cost, and putting an accurate price tag on an Afghan surge is tough.
Part of the problem that you have is that it depends on how much of a Christmas tree the Afghan war budget turns into.
Still, congressional leaders are bracing for a roughly $30 billion budget request. Speaking on WBUR's Here and Now earlier today, Congressman David Obie, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, proposed a new war surtax to pay for it.
If we don't do something like this, the cost of the Afghan war over the next 10 years could devour virtually every effort that we want to make to rebuild our own economy here at home.
Obie's bill's already gained support from other important House leaders, including Charlie Rangel, the powerful tax-writing chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
As we learned in Iraq, with military occupation nowadays usually comes civilian contractors. Steve will explore those costs for us on the broadcast tomorrow. According to the Associated Press, 14 states now permit some kind of access to medical marijuana. Five of them, that'd be California, Colorado, Maine, New Mexico, and Rhode Island, allow retail dispensaries. But even those states are still wrestling with the specifics of what amounts to the marketing of marijuana. The Los Angeles City Council took up the issue today amid growing political pressure to shut down most of its thriving pot business. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports that when voters approve the idea of medical marijuana, they often leave the details kind of fuzzy.
With marijuana dispensaries sprouting up across L.A. like you-know-what, could one be coming soon to a neighborhood near you?
I think we've developed a fairly effective model in California.
Chris Hermes speaks for the advocacy group Americans for Safe Access.
We have been helping patients and advocates work with their local governments over the last few years to adopt sensible regulations for these facilities.
It's been 13 years since California voters became the first to legalize medical marijuana, but what's legal and what's not remains in doubt and largely unregulated. In San Diego, Will Johnson told our affiliate KPBS that his Kind Gardeners Collective grows its plants wherever.
We have somebody's patio, somebody's spare bedroom. We have an area in a commercial office. This next month, we'll have the basement of a residential home.
Some city officials here contend many of L.A.'s roughly 1,000 outlets are just illegal drug dens reaping big profits. San Francisco has tighter rules and only about 30 such outlets. Patient advocate Chris Hermes says that's because L.A.'s a much bigger city, and he insists most have a legitimate reason to be open.
These facilities are indeed providing medical marijuana to qualified patients and their primary caregivers. That is not in question.
But KPCC reporter Frank Stoltz found out the definition of qualified is itself an open question. He spoke to Antonio Gracia, a 19-year-old patient with a prescription outside one L.A. dispensary.
My prescription is for stress.
What's stressing you out?
Probably because I've been smoking medical marijuana all my life. So when I don't use it, I stress.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Not much stress on Wall Street today. The major indices ended almost where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In just a couple of minutes, you'll hear a discussion of the economics of gift giving. I hope I'm not giving too much away here when I say you should think very carefully before you really shell out for something nice this year. First, though, the other end of that gift transaction. Retailers are bracing themselves for waves of post-Thanksgiving shoppers later this week. That will, inevitably, be followed by waves of post-Christmas returns, both legitimate and not. Fraud is on the rise, and retailers are often left holding the bag. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The National Retail Federation says stores will lose more than $2.5 billion this holiday season to fraud, including something known as friendly fraud. Friendly because consumers think of it as more bending the rules than stealing. Take chargebacks. That's when a shopper charges something, then tells the credit card company, "Hey, I never charged that." Or they order something online and claim it never showed up. If merchants get hit with too many chargebacks, the credit card company will fine them, up to $100 a pop.
Retailers become a victim.
That's Joseph LaRocca. He's a loss prevention expert at the National Retail Federation. He says stores with lots of chargebacks also pay higher transaction fees to credit card companies.
When you're doing millions of dollars of business or billions of dollars of business on a particular credit card, those transactions all add up.
And chargebacks aren't the only types of friendly fraud. We all know that shopper who buys it, wears it, and returns it. Valerie Folks teaches marketing at the University of Southern California. She says times are tough, but consumers don't want to do without.
What that leads to sometimes is consumers engaging in behaviors that maybe they can justify them to themselves are really okay, but in fact are really unethical.
Michael Fisher is bracing for a wave of holiday hucksters. His family owns two electronics stores in northwest Iowa. He says in this economy, there's no wiggle room. So if someone buys a big screen TV for that Super Bowl party, then returns it, there's no refund.
We don't have a lot of give. There's no margin for error right now.
Fisher has company. The National Retail Federation says almost 16% of retailers surveyed will tighten their return policies this holiday season. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Even in a lousy economy, most of us are still probably thinking about what to get for our kids or for Grandma or for Aunt Mary for the holidays, just because that's what you do this time of year. But Joel Waldfogel says we should rethink that whole gift-giving thing. It just doesn't make sense, he says, once you do the math. Waldfogel is an economist at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and his new book about the season of not giving is called Scroogenomics. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to say, this plays right into my prejudice here because I'm just not a good holiday gift giver. But you say it actually doesn't make any sense.
Well, the problem is that, normally we go out and buy things for ourselves. We'll only spend $50 if we find something that's worth at least $50 to us. But with gift giving, it's entirely different. You know, we're operating at an enormous handicap. We don't know what the other person wants or needs. So, you know, if I spend $50 on you, I might buy something that you wouldn't pay anything for.
But I place value on that gift that you give me, right? So isn't there value there?
You may place value on the fact that I gave you something. The problem is the actual thing I get you is something that you typically place less value on than the thing that you would have purchased with the same amount of money. So the spending doesn't produce as much satisfaction as we expect spending to produce.
On the theory that my mother's listening, I will ask this question on her behalf because this is what she does with my kids, her grandchildren. Cash, man. $25 is $25.
Well, she's an efficient spirit. I mean, I wouldn't advocate it for everyone because some people find giving cash distasteful, but it is quite common. Grandparents and aunts and uncles especially are most likely to give cash. And it's a real interesting evidence of a desire for efficiency because those are precisely the givers who are in least frequent contact with their recipients. They know least about the specific wants of the recipients. And what would you do if you were in that circumstance and you didn't want to destroy value? You'd give cash. So I'd say that your mother is a paragon of efficiency.
Do we have any idea? I thank you on her behalf, by the way. Do we have any idea? Can you quantify how much value is destroyed in Christmas gift giving?
I wouldn't be much of an economist if I didn't take a stab at that. We spend on holiday gifts in the U.S. about $65 billion per year. Now, I get that number from the difference between December non-seasonally adjusted retail sales and the average of November and January. Others will estimate them to be much higher, but I think that's a conservative way to do it. So $65 billion in spending. I've done a lot of surveys over the years in which I ask people, how much do you value the stuff you've received as gifts, and what do you think the giver paid? And I also ask them the same questions about items they've purchased for themselves. Mm-hmm. The answer I've come to is that people value stuff they receive as gifts 20% less per dollar spent than stuff they buy for themselves. So multiplying that 20% times that $65 billion gets you to about $12 or $13 billion a year in destroyed value or missing satisfaction in the U.S. Worldwide, the number is about twice that big.
Has it always been this way? I mean, 100 years ago when folks shopped for Christmas, was the value destruction metric the same?
Well, I don't have any direct evidence about the size of the value destruction, but what I was surprised to learn in researching the book was that the Christmas of our parents and our grandparents and perhaps even our great-grandparents in the U.S. was as much of a commercial big deal, if not more of a big deal. I mean, the amount of holiday spending in relation, say, to the size of the U.S. economy actually was larger in 1935 than it is today.
Before we let you go, I have to observe that your book is small. It's quite compact, just the perfect size to, fit in a stocking maybe?
That is a thought.
And one that I'm sure, you know, you're just coming to now, right?
Well, my handlers, I guess, came up with that. I mean, my view on this, of course, since I'm a bit skeptical of gift giving, I guess my view is buy it for yourself. And if you don't like it, give it as a gift.
Joel Waldfogel, his new book is called Scroogenomics. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, making the case for mining in Ghana.
They are contributing a lot to the local community. Some have been providing them with hospitals, roads, schools.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials paired off 17 points today, a tenth of 1%, ended at 10,433. NASDAQ raced 6 points, 0.3%, closed at 2169. The S&P 500 lost about a half a point. Call that flat, 1105 at the bell. Morgan Stanley lost 1.5% today. Goldman Sachs parted with a half of 1%. Barnes & Noble closed its books on the day, down more than 5%. Second quarter losses widened, and the company cut its annual earnings forecast. Hewlett-Packard lost 1.6%. The computer and printer maker reported a quarterly profit that matched preliminary estimates, but said the economy remains, quote, challenging. Dell peeled off more than 3% today. Price on the 10-year T-note rose. That pushed the yield down to 3.3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as The Splendid Table, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department cranks out three reports for October: durable goods, personal income and spending, and new home sales. It's traditional business at the White House. President Obama pardons the turkey in the Rose Garden. And workers across the country try to cut the day short to get the long holiday weekend started a little early and beat the traffic. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The dollar actually held steady against the euro today. Nice, but not in keeping with the greenback's recent performance. In the past 8 months, the dollar has lost almost a fifth of its value against a basket of other currencies. You know, a weak currency can work for you, or it can work against you, depending on where you sit. But given the way the dollar has been trading, and the fact that it can be borrowed for practically nothing, thanks to low interest rates here, the foreign exchange market is at the heart of what could be the next big bubble. Marketplace's Scott Tong joins us from Shanghai. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right. Listen, so we've been talking a little bit about bubbles on the broadcast last couple of weeks, and we were curious as to what you are experiencing over there.
Well, it does feel like the zero gravity chamber here in Greater China, that property prices cannot fall here. I mean, you hear it all the time in the taxis, wherever, and in Chinese they say, "Die bu sha lai," it can never fall. In Hong Kong last month, one apartment went for a world record price of $64 million. So yes, it's 6,000 square feet. Yes, it has a ballroom and an outdoor pool and a view of the harbor. But per square foot, it's 11 grand.
Wow.
That's more than any London flat or New York apartment ever. So if you look in emerging markets in general in the world, you have people worrying. The people at the World Bank, top Chinese bank regulators, brand name economists are all voicing some angst that these prices are too high. And one big thing they cite is the weak U.S. dollar as a reason.
Connect the dots here for me, would you? It's this thing, this mechanism called the carry trade, right?
Well, yeah. And basically, here's how it works. Let's say you, Kai, you go to your local bank in Los Angeles and you borrow some money basically for free, right?
Yep.
Half of 1%.
Yep.
And you take all those cheap dollars and you go offshore. Convert them, say, to New Zealand money. You stick it there for a year and the Kiwi bank gives you 4.5% interest.
Mm-hmm.
Indonesian banks will give you 7%. Brazil will give you 10%. And since there are a whole lot of U.S. dollars to borrow, that is a lot of low-cost leverage for investors, hedge funds, whatever, to buy something exciting overseas, and all these overseas asset prices are up.
A lot of U.S. dollars to borrow because the Treasury needs to sell a whole bunch of Treasury bills to finance its debt, yes?
Well, there are a whole lot of bonds out there to buy, but even before all this, there were just a whole lot of U.S. dollars available for anyone on the planet to access. You know how they say when the U.S. sneezes, the world catches a cold? Well, this is kind of the opposite. When the U.S. takes economic steroids, the rest of the world pumps up.
All right, Scott, but riddle me this. What happens if the dollar goes up?
Then we listen for the sound of bubbles popping around the world. I mean, say global investors start to freak out, right? The recession gets worse or there's geopolitical unrest somewhere, and then they scurry to the world's financial bomb shelter. You know, the safe haven is the U.S. dollar. Yeah. So people buy U.S. dollars, it goes up, and New Zealand dollars suddenly go down in value. And suddenly all those great New Zealand investments become kind of worthless. And then you have to bring those dollars back to the States and pay back your banker. Well, uh-oh. So you sell. And then I sell, and then my brother sells, and then we have the bad case scenario. The fear is there's this coordinated crash in asset prices around the world. And it could all go south. It could all go south if the dollar doesn't behave the way we all think it will.
All right. Well, that's the doom and gloom. Any sunshine and light?
Well, yeah. The sunshine people say, listen, stock and property prices in these emerging markets are up for a real good reason because the economies there are doing well. They're sound. So it's not just a bunch of currency speculators throwing their money in and ready to take it out. It's long-term investments in these high-growth places. And that certainly could be. But I tell you, Kai, at least a couple countries are hedging against that. Brazil last month said, you know, all that foreign money rushing into Brazil, you're not so welcome anymore. We're going to tax you. And Taiwan just said, you know, just keep out, period. Foreigners are banned from parking their money in our banks. Because these countries, they've been burned before. They remember the 97 Asian financial crisis. A lot of them crashed the last couple of years with the global crisis. And currency risk is what this is all about. You know, most Americans don't ever think about currency risk. But here, you know, if you go down on the street and ask the random Chinese person what the exchange rate is to the dollar or to the euro, they know.
That's amazing. Scott Tong in Shanghai for us. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thank you.
November has been a very good month for gold bugs. Prices are up 12% in the past 24 days. 1 point this afternoon, it was worth $1,174 an ounce. With record high prices like that, mining companies are digging pretty much wherever they can. And a lot of them are rushing to West Africa for a piece of that action. Ghana is one of the world's top producers of gold. It is, after all, part of what used to be called Africa's Gold Coast. And today, five times more gold comes out of the ground there than it did in the early 1990s. Not always, though, with benefit to local residents. Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports.
At the government's Minerals Commission in the capital city of Accra, Director Joseph Abuaje unfurls a huge map onto his desk.
We have a map showing all the concessions that have been granted in the country.
Red and blue boxes on the map show where companies are looking for gold. Green is where there's active mining. The gold-rich areas of Ghana are saturated with colors. They're covered in mining activity.
There's very few parts that are not covered, it looks like.
Yeah, that's true. But you can still see some open spaces.
The map didn't always look this colorful. But Abuaje says in 2006, his government changed its mining laws to attract international investors.
The old law was operated for about 20 years. And then somewhere along the line, we saw that we were not competitive. So we reviewed it.
The map now shows that over 220 companies are mining or looking for gold in Ghana. One of them is Newmont. The Colorado-based miner is one of the world's top producers of gold. Right now, Newmont has one surface mine in Ghana. It was built by blasting almost 500 million tons of rocks out of the ground. It's a huge amount of work. For every three rocks that come out, only one of them has gold. The rest of the debris has to go somewhere, usually on land where locals live and farm. Newmont had to relocate about 10,000 people to make way for its mine. In one resettlement community, Amanok Pata feeds her toddler in front of the small yellow house Newmont moved her to 4 years ago. She says life is worse after the move.
They deceived us. They really lied to us a lot. All the promises they made, they haven't kept one of them. They said we wouldn't have to buy water. Water would be piped to all of our houses for free. They'd give us electricity. They'd employ our husbands. A whole lot of promises.
Newmont declined to comment for this story, but activists and community leaders on both sides have been vocal about the company's operations. Recently, Newmont has gotten a lot of attention for its plans to open another, equally large mine northeast of Accra. Martha Asamoah is cutting back weeds on her orange and palm tree farm. Once the new mine is built, this place will be a reservoir for ore after the gold is extracted. Mine waste. Martha and the other farmers on this land will get compensation from Newmont. The company pays about $1,400 for an acre of palm trees. But Martha says she can earn around that much every single year over the tree's lifespan, 25 years.
If I continue to grow my crops, I'd earn more and more each year as the trees get bigger. Every year it adds up. And so that's why we don't want Newmont to come here.
But many locals are hopeful about the potential mine. They see new jobs and new development. The community leaders in the area have all spoken up in support of the new project. At the government's Minerals Commission, Joseph Abuaje says the mining companies have been good for Ghana.
They are contributing a lot to the local community. Some have been providing them with hospitals, roads, schools.
Some place it helps people.
Belinda Sesu is frying fish and sweet potatoes by the side of the road near Newmont's proposed mine site. She says her business will improve when the mine opens. But she's also worried about the town's future. She knows some waste products from mining contain cyanide.
I think we have disease. The chemicals they'll be using here will affect us sometimes.
Last month, Newmont's current mine had a cyanide spill, killing fish in a nearby river. The company says it was a small incident and has been cleaned up. For now, Newmont is waiting for the Ghanaian government to sign off on the new mine. The company says its new mine will produce just as much gold as the current one. That mine earned almost $175 million last year. In Accra, Ghana, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, you know, before I settled into a life of schlepping kids around in a minivan, I always wanted to drive a Saab convertible. Never did quite manage to get that done, and now my chance may be gone. General Motors, as you may or may not know, owns the Swedish automaker. And General Motors, as you do probably know, is in some trouble. It's been trying to unload Saab for a while now, and a deal with a Swedish buyer was announced back in June. Today, that buyer backed out. GM says it's going to take a couple of days to figure out what to do now, but speculation is that Saab may not be long for this world. My minivan, though, it's really cool. I mean, I really like it. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 17 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq dribbled down 6.3%. The S&P 500 down half a point. We'll call that one flat. Thanks to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Beed, and that is where you can get all the latest business and economic news first thing tomorrow morning. Coming up next time on this broadcast, why scarcity might help holiday sales.
When people are told that they can't get something or something is in limited supply, demand for that soars. The minute you limit the customer, whoop, they'll buy a lot more.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.